important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, ricksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Big day of craziness. I'm here to share a little bit more of the insanity. Luke Vargas, Talk Media News. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
You're very welcome. Happy Tuesday.
Yeah, big day. Evidently, shutdown. I was expecting shutdown, maybe not.
It's really unclear. In the past hour, I've read a report from the Associated Press and a report by the New York Times, which offer very contradictory sort of indications about where this budget showdown is going to go. The New York Times saying the White House has backtracked a little bit on its insistence that border wall funding is a necessary component of averting a government shutdown. The Associated Press saying that no, the positions are sort of hardening and even a possibly brief shutdown looks more and more likely. Either way, I mean, it does appear that the border wall posturing is part of the deliberations here. The sticking point, though, seems to be relatively minor. I mean, ideologically, it's big, but we're talking probably around $3.5 billion worth of border wall funding, which is a drop in the bucket for the cost of the wall itself. And it's absolute pennies in comparison to the, what is it, $4 trillion? Dollar federal budget. Hold on, I've got to sneeze. But, you know, it's pennies. And it makes you think, and I know Ezra Klein had put out a story suggesting this several weeks ago, and I don't know if it got a lot of traction or not, but it's sort of been hanging around in the back of my mind, and it sort of seems to explain things more and more, which is that Trump doesn't really want a deal here. He doesn't want this wall, because if he wanted it or if he needed this $3 billion of funding, it's such a small amount in the grand scheme of things that he could find any number of things to offer up to Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to get this done. Bear in mind, there was a deal last year to give protections to Dreamers through DACA in exchange for border wall funding, and he balked at that. I mean, and that seemed to be a pretty, you know, big concession from both sides, and it would have gotten the wall fixed. And now that's even smaller, ostensibly. $3 billion is really nothing. So, you know, it does sort of support, you know, this sort of lack of clarity about where each side stands right now, particularly President Trump. It almost becomes more clear to sort of say he doesn't want a deal. It's more politically powerful for him to be able to say, I am the one with the silver bullet solution to this illegal immigration problem. And the only thing standing in my way from fixing this once and for all is political obstruction and a lack of compromise from my opponents, the Democrats. Yeah. Whereas, you know, going behind closed doors, making a deal, compromising a little bit, sort of seeing this issue from the side of your opponent, which is how deal making works, that really actually waters down his message. And were the wall to be built, and as most experts say, it would fail to stop illegal immigration, then the onus would shift from being on the Democrats to build the wall to Trump. Why did you say this was going to fix everything, and why hasn't it fixed everything now that it's built? So I almost wonder if President Trump prefers not to make a deal here, and that almost seems to be the sort of line of best fit for this very confused talk coming from the White House about sort of how this thing should get done.
So I got two thoughts. The first is, wow, you really give him a lot of credit for being smart.
He knows how to write drama.
This is a level of thought that, you know, and sophistication that I don't think most people would give him credit for. So, you know, good on you. The other part of it is it possible he's just really crummy at the art of the deal? Because if you watched him sit down with Chuck and Nancy, if you watched that deliberation there, that you know, discussion, that deal making process, he's really bad at it. I mean, you know, he got so off his game that he said he'd be happy, he'd be proud to take responsibility for the shutdown. And then you got to imagine that everybody in the room was going, no, don't say that, bad. No?
Well, but I think many of these things can be true at once. I mean, I do think you're right. He seemed to think that a public confrontation with Chuck and Nancy in the Oval Office was going to be great for him. And according to those reports, that he like threw a binder full of papers against a wall as soon as he walked out of the meeting, and Pelosi seemed to sort of at times get the better of him in their sort of TV sparring, suggests that it backfired a little bit. But I still think even if he's showing himself to be a poor negotiator, I ultimately think if you're going to basically turn the border wall into the like kind of hill you die on in terms of policies, you know, keeping it as a dream that's never realized, a sort of conservative immigration policy holy grail, that is a much more sort of sacrosanct place for that idea than actually testing it out in the realm of actual policy and seeing that, you know, in front and center, that it's not what you thought it was.
Yeah,
so
I can see that.
I think insofar as that's the case, I think Trump, you know, he may not be a great deal maker, but he's still, he's still smart enough to realize that, you know, you should probably keep this on the back burner as opposed to deploying it.
And you keep the dogs chasing the car. I get it. That
yeah.
Makes
yeah.
sense. And look, you get to play the victim. So even better yet,
exactly.
Still there.
Yeah, terrific, yeah.
And today, a victim day. Evidently, he's going to have to shut down the Trump Foundation.
Well, he said he was going to do it anyways, but he seemed to want to shut the Trump Foundation down because then he thought it would hold off any scrutiny of what he had been doing for many, many years at the Trump Foundation. And so he's not going to shut it down the way he wants. It's going to be a supervised closure overseen by the New York Attorney General, who sued the Trump Foundation, basically saying that this was a nonprofit that was engaged in what she said was a shocking pattern of illegality, end quote, and also repeatedly and willfully was engaged in self-dealing, i.e. sort of taking Trump was taking money from this foundation, helping out his own causes. There are three sort of stories of how this foundation used its money that are pretty shocking. One of them people will know about, which is that he used the foundation to pay one of his resorts, I believe it was Mar-a-Lago, $10,000 to buy a portrait of Donald J. Trump. So basically just moving money around between his entities. There's no reason why a charity would need that portrait. I think they claimed that they were going to auction it off or something, but it seems very, very self-obsessed, to say the least. The second was there was a golf tournament at one of the Trump golf properties in New Jersey, and this businessman hits a hole-in-one on a hole, where there's some sort of competition, hit a hole-in-one, win $1 million. And he hits a hole-in-one, and then the course doesn't want to pay up. So the guy sues, and they settled the case for $168,000. Guess who pays the settlement with the guy?
The Trump Foundation.
Of course. I love that. And then finally, you had Trump dodge a Fox News debate in early 2016 in the heat of the primaries. And he says, no, you know, that fake news media can't buy into this or whatever. I forget exactly what his excuse du jour was. It could have been that he probably didn't want Ted Cruz to be getting any free airtime that he didn't need to be getting, and realized most people would just not watch the debate if the front runner weren't there. So he says, look, I'm going to hold a televised fundraiser for veterans.
I remember.
And I'm going to give $6 million. We raised $6 million. Well, months later, David Fahrenthold of the Washington Post starts poking around and finds that the money hadn't gone to veterans charities. When pressured on it, Trump finally releases a list of people who are going to get the money and says, all right, it's all settled up. Well, further reporting, as it turns out, the attorney general here now sees only $2.8 million was ever given out. We don't really know about the other 3.2. Presumably it either was never raised or never given out. I think maybe never raised is the more perhaps the right answer here. But again, an instance where had investigative journalists not been probing this, the Trump Foundation likely would have been relegated to one of the many, many thousands of, as a contributor to CNN says, sort of opaque nonprofits where, you know, shady stuff is going on, sometimes illegal, but is never investigated because it's quite difficult to force open you know, their fundraising books and look at their accounts. And so had it not been for dogged journalism, none of this would have come to light. And again, I think it's very important people see the extent to which, you know, there is just this self-serving nature to a lot of what the president had been up to here, and not a whole lot of evidence to suggest this was an organization driven by, you know, charitable instinct.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, you know, the more we find out, the more we realize that, you know, he's probably doing the same thing in the White House. I mean, it's all about funding him.
Yeah, and I think, as we'll talk in a second about Michael Flynn, but, I mean, you get – there's a point on a lot of this Trump stuff where it may not be collusion, right? His crimes are not all about collusion with foreign actors. A lot of it is either just sort of immorality, right? The sort of – it's just wrong to take people's money that they believe is going to a charitable cause and then use it to settle – lawsuits where you ripped a guy off at a golf competition, you know, or just to, you know, buy portraits of yourself from yourself. There's also this issue of incompetence, which does seem to be a Trump family hallmark, which is that the Attorney General of New York here cites the foundation for a failure to follow basic fiduciary obligations and failure to implement even basic corporate regulations, fiduciary regulations that are required by law, saying that, you know, you have all these people that you say are on the board of this charity, but they don't do anything. Like, that's not right. You're supposed to be having meetings. You're supposed to be bookkeeping in a certain way, and they weren't doing any of that either. So, again, the you know, sort of the problems with the way Trump and his family do business, it's not necessarily that they're in cahoots with other people all the time. So they're just sort of bad at running things and sometimes breaking the law because of how bad they're running things. And other chances, just sort of ripping people off and stiffing people. And I think that is reprehensible in and of itself. It doesn't need to be some grand conspiracy all the time.
No, I don't say it's a grand conspiracy. I've always said he's a con man. This is right. What con men do. I mean, hello. Exactly. You know, in collusion, he's colluding with himself. Look, at the end of the day, if he can put a buck in his pocket and take it out of yours, these are people who feel entitled, and they're going to do it. You know, laws be damned.
Yeah, and I mean, and that I think is a great transition to Michael Flynn, who today, you know, at a court sentencing is basically pressed by this judge, Emmett Sullivan, to make sure that he is indeed willingly pleading guilty to these charges against him, which is a really interesting point because, as we mentioned last week, you had Flynn's legal team put forward this memo last week basically saying, look, I mean, our client was coerced by the FBI into this testimony. He didn't even lie in the first place, but then all the circumstances around being questioned by the agents was improper. He didn't know that lying to the FBI was a crime because it wasn't explicitly read out to him every time he sat down with FBI investigators. And then on Friday, at the end of the week, the Mueller team, in sort of uncharacteristic fashion, because they've been pretty tight-lipped and don't often sort of get into details about anecdotes and putting all the – they don't need to, in many cases, throw a ton of supporting evidence behind a lot of what they're saying because the evidence speaks for itself. But here, sort of responding to this insinuation that they were acting, you know, out of line – pile it on really hard and say, look, there's just no way a man who led the Defense Intelligence Agency, presided over all sorts of federal investigations, has, I guess, talked to investigators of the FBI in the past, et cetera, could possibly think that lying to the FBI was not a crime. Here are all these examples of him being extraordinarily chatty and forthcoming. It's not as if they were, you know, waterboarding him to get secrets out of him. He was like willingly coughing up all sorts of evidence, you know, in a cheerful manner to the FBI. He wasn't having his arm twisted. And I think you saw today evidence that legal, you know, strategy really backfired, that now, you know, you saw the judge basically saying, so you're pleading guilty. And then, you know, and then asking the attorneys for Flynn, you know, then why would you then, you know, your client is willfully pleading guilty. Why would you then insinuate that he never lied? Or right. I think that legal, they basically had to run away with their tail between their legs here. And I think that will inform the way other Trump co-conspirators craft their legal strategies. That it's one thing to sort of try and tarnish Mueller in the press. And I think that will continue to be effective, at least among supporters of the president. But doing so in a legal setting and trying to outbox Bob Mueller using sort of B-list attorneys on crackpot theories is not going to really work very well. And I think you saw that today. And so Flynn evidently is going to cooperate a little bit more with the FBI, testifying against two associates, and see if that will get him any extra leniency from the judge. But given what the judge said today, this bombshell kind of quote that everyone's talking about, that, you know, you sort of sold your country out by being an unregistered foreign agent while serving as the national security advisor to the president, suggests that Flynn's probably is not going to be treated too leniently here. And I think the legal defense mounted on his behalf has only made his life worse.
Yeah, it's interesting, but I still find it very interesting that Flynn claimed didn't know he can't lie to the FBI. Does he never watch Law and Order or any of those things? They tell you have the right to remain silent. Maybe you should use that.
Yeah, it's completely not a viable excuse, and I was glad to see that.
And I loved Trump apologist Alan Dershowitz's theory on this that. Evidently, the way Dershowitz sees it, the FBI already knew the truth. So, in fact, he tweeted out, when the FBI already has a recording of a meeting and asks whether that meeting occurred, a false answer is not material to the investigation. The only reason is to test the witness, not to learn information. Morality tests are not the proper role of the FBI. And you go, but you ask the question to see if they're going to lie to you. And if they lied to you, they lied to you. They still lied.
Yeah, I mean, I am not a lawyer.
You don't need to be a lawyer. It's common sense. Look, if you're not telling the truth, you're lying.
Yeah, clearly. And I think, at the very least, the longer these indictments continue, the sort of true character, the instinct of so many people in the Trump orbit to lie so casually is coming out loud and clear, yeah. And I think that is quite damning.
Crazy. Let's move along. Nikki Haley, still the UN ambassador? I thought she was leaving.
Man, this is her sort of swan song. I mean, this is one of her last speeches today. She teased the long-awaited Trump Middle East peace plan in vague reference, saying that she'd actually read it and she thought it was great, that it gets into detail in areas where past peace plans just had these lack of specifics and unimaginative guidelines, that this one really gets into the technologies of the day. It was all this weird jargon, but didn't point to any specific details of this actual agreement. But her reference to technology and her repeated insistence that Israel wants a deal but doesn't need one, whereas the Palestinians really need a deal but their politicians don't want one, tells us two things. One is that the Trump administration really does confirm these reports that we've been seeing for some time, that at the core of this peace plan, and we don't know the details about territory and whether it's going to be a two-state solution or what, but it is believed that what the administration is going to do is bring together a bunch of Gulf states and sort of Arab states and have them agree, both governments and private sector companies, to a big investment sort of development plan, either in Gaza and or in the West Bank. And this is a little bit like what we've seen from the administration as it pertains to sort of domestic economic investment, which is, let's identify these, what is it, 1,000 or several hundred special opportunity zones where, you know, the economy isn't quite working ideally, or there's some undeveloped land, and let's like basically carve out some special tax status and then get a bunch of people to build a factory or a business park there, and then the local community will benefit from the jobs. And clearly, I think you've probably talked about how a lot of the places identified by the Trump administration for this in the United States are pretty undeserving and are probably just ways kicking business over to friends without, you know, having to pay full taxes on them. But yep. There, you know, there does seem to be some of that thinking in this peace process that, hey, you know, let's first cut off aid to Palestine for a year and direct our allies to basically try and economically and humanitarian terms isolate Palestine, then emphasize how poor they are and how in need of money they are, and then offer them some sort of deal where in exchange for compromising on the 1968 or pre-1968 borders, the borders that Palestine and its citizens have long thought should be the foundation of any future state, in exchange, you'll get them some cash and some jobs and some, you know, foreign investment, and that will, you know, sort of satiate them. I happen to think and have long maintained this is an incredibly cynical way to approach these longstanding grievances of the Palestinian people, and is the kind of plan that could only be drafted up by someone as ill-qualified to be a neutral arbiter of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process as Jared Kushner, who I think has shown time and time again to lack the ability to be a competent mediator between these two sides. He's entitled to think whatever he wants, but I think it is foolish to presume someone with such a close affinity to the state of Israel and its current prime minister could effectively serve as a mediator here. Yeah. And so I think he lacks credibility, and I think this plan is quite cynical. However, Nikki Haley says she's read it. It's terrific. And other administration officials say, look for the deal to drop early next year. Fingers, we'll see it. That's been touted before too, that it's just around the corner and it hasn't come to fruition.
It's like all these secret plans. I can't wait to see them. Generally, I think they're just blank pieces of paper, but can't wait to see them.
Yep, we'll see.
And finally, Britain's Royal Statistical Society has chosen their statistic of the year. What's the statistic of the year?
I've never covered this before, but I thought it was sort of interesting. It's not a happy one. It's 90.5, which is the percentage of plastic waste that has never been recycled, that has either just gone into landfills or into the natural environment. So that's a horrifying statistic. The runner-ups, which I just will mention very briefly in a sentence each, 40%, which is the percentage of Russian men who will not live to age 65, which is the proposed state pension age for men proposed by President Vladimir Putin as a part of his economic reforms, which is a very clever British Statistical Society dig at the state of things in Russia. And finally, for the UK, the statistical runner-up for the year, 6.4, the percentage of female executives within the FTSE 250, which is the 250 largest companies listed on the London Stock Exchange. So that's pretty bad across the board. Russian men aren't living long enough to collect their pensions. Most, if not almost all, of the plastic ever produced in the world is just getting dumped into the natural environment, and women are still systematically denied a chance to serve on you know, senior board positions in the United Kingdom. So not great there, but that 90.5 number really blew my mind and confirmed all of my worst fears about pollution.
Now, I wonder how they came up with that.
They did say they had to sort of approximate because they're trying to do a historical look back. I think with the current production, it's a little bit easier to get a number. But in my read through this press release earlier today, I think they consulted out that number, and the firm that tallied it up did acknowledge they had to kind of guesstimate it. But I mean, give or take 5%, we're still in a pretty bad place.
Yeah, plastic bags, worst thing ever developed.
My wife and I have a house here in New Jersey, and we live on a street with a lot of big families. And I notice every recycling day, and it's going to be recycling day tomorrow, we have like way more recycling than anyone else. And on one hand, like, great, we're recycling a lot. But the downside is we're just using way too much plastic. And so at some point, the solution, particularly as so many American municipalities fail to have really any infrastructure in place other than just shipping plastic to China to actually recycle, you've got to hit the solution has to come in a way from less reliance on plastic in the first place.
Exactly.
You've got to have better manufacturing or just change people's purchasing habits. But just saying, oh, yeah, I have five giant cans of recycling every week. Aren't I a terrific environmentalist? Well, you might be generating too much in the first place. I think we've got to look at all of it.
Good stuff. Luke, appreciate the time, man.
Thank you, Rick. Take care.
As always, Luke Vargas, Talk Media News. He's their chief foreign correspondent. You make sure you check out his podcast, The World in Two, which you hear on the program every day as well. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.